Check.
CQ. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Coming through?
Yeah. Can people hear?
Da-da-da.
Can you hear in the back, yes? No?
What do I have to say?
No, I'm gonna have to turn it up.
No, you don't have to hold it.
Will it work if I just lay it down like that?
Not really.
Just to hold it?
Yeah. Let's see. Let me come back, I'll...
CQ, hello, testing. Pardon me? All right, go ahead.
Can you hear me in the back? Or should I use the mic?
CQ.
Okay, well, welcome to our first internal colloquium for the year. Our speaker for today is Dr. Paul Meehl, who's Regents Professor...
Hi.
Get away from the speaker.
Come on the other side.
Who is Regents Professor Emeritus here in the Department of Psychology. He was born in Minneapolis, raised in Minneapolis, got his bachelor's degree here at the U of M, got his PhD here at the University of Minnesota from this department in 1945, and has been professor here ever since. Among his many famous research accomplishments, he's also had his own psychotherapy private practice for over 40 years and has been president of the American Psychological Association. Among his professional interests are taxometrics, behavior genetics, etiology of schizophrenia, theory of diagnosis, philosophy of science, forensic psychology, political psychology, and ethical theory. His works are world-renowned, and among them are his critique of null hypothesis significance testing, which he'll talk to us about today. Please join me in welcoming our very distinguished speaker, Dr. Paul Meehl.
Thank you. Legally blind, and if somebody frowns or is pleased or puzzled, I can't tell that. I know you're there, but I can't read your expressions. And so, can you hear me in the back?
No, you got to speak loud.
All right.
Speak back in the room, even with the mic.
Okay. I'll do my darnest. And so I don't have an outline, and I have to rely on my memory when I last talked about this. And finally, I'm just recovering from a bout of pneumonia, so I'm a little rocky. Hence, if the talk sounds a bit disjointed, that's the reason why, and my apologies. First, a matter of terminology on the board. My wife, Dr. Jantz, has put up at the top TOSS, T-O-S-S, which is an acronym that's coming into use, Tests of Statistical Significance. And then under that, two subspecies, which I call the weak and the strong use. And the criticisms that I have against the weak use do not apply to the strong. Nor have any critics, to my knowledge, like David Licken, who with me was one of the earliest critics, have objected to the strong use. You all know the essential thing about a test of significance. We assume a certain value for a population, a mean or a standard deviation or a correlation coefficient. We draw a sample. We don't expect the sample will be exactly the same as the supply, and the mathematicians have given us formulas and tables. So we can ask, is this observed value of the mean or of the mean difference or of the correlation so far off from our hypothetical value that it can't be right? You can't translate that directly into a probability according to some people. For other people, if you think you're right, you can, and I'm not going to go into that unless you want me to. I have a somewhat deviant view on that subject.
Speak to the back of the room. They can't hear you back
there. Well,
even with the microphone, they can't hear you.
Well, I can't talk much louder.
Well, just talk as if you have to hear that.
All right, I'll do my damnedest. In the strong use, which is what we find in physics, astronomy, chemistry, geology, and frequently genetics, in the strong use, our theory is strong enough to predict a numerical point prediction. We have to always distinguish between the theory, the substantive causal theory that we have in mind, and the statistical hypothesis H. Most statistics books don't even alert you to that. It's amazing. And that is one of the sources of the confusion. The theory, the substantive causal theory, postulates certain kinds of entities or processes, usually not directly observed, alone in another science they may be. It talks about genes or unconscious wishes, positrons, libido, or habit strengths, and that's obviously not the same as a statistical remark, but it derives or entails a statistical remark. In the strong use, the scientist, if he likes his theory, hopes not to get significance. The theory entails a hypothesis H star, a certain numerical value. Like, if you do this in the lab, it should weigh 1.732 grams. And if it doesn't, that speaks against the theory. In our field, if Meehl's theory of schizophrenia were correct, 50% of the siblings should have a schizotaxic brain detected by neurological signs. Or so-and-so's theory of the heredity of intelligence, the IQ of a child should correlate 50 with its parent, and some other value, I forget the number, like 78 with the mid-parent. Or on so-and-so's theory of genetics and environment with IQ, a person who has a step-parent, his IQ should be, let's say, 3/4 of the way between the step-parent and his biological parents. You make a prediction, a numerical prediction, H star, which flows from your theory. In the weak use, the theory is not powerful enough to do that. All the theory is able to predict is that something will be bigger than nothing, that the correlation won't be zero, or that the difference between the two, between the males and the females, will not be zero. In that case, if we like our theory, we want to get statistical significance because the point value is H null, meaning no correlation or no difference. So while the math is the same in the two uses, the logical structure of the argument is exactly in reverse. So I am not criticizing the mathematics of null hypothesis significance testing. If Neil got into a debate with R.A. Fisher about the mathematics, we know who would lose. But the logical structure is different. When physicists use significance tests, they don't usually call them that because they were doing it before Fisher was born. They consider a significant result to talk against the theory because the theory predicts a point value H star. In soft psychology, such as my field, I'm not casting any aspersions when I use that word. I mean that clinical and counseling and personality and social psych are not like, say, the psychology of visual perception or some aspects of animal learning theory. In the soft psychology fields, we consider when we reach significance, meaning we show that it can't be H null, that the theory has been supported. And what makes it weak, in the philosopher's sense, is that that is a very broad prediction. Anywhere from zero on up will count as support. And since, as Likert and others have argued, almost everybody agrees, H null in soft psychology is never true, that means that whether you succeed in refuting it depends upon the power function. You all know about type 1 and type 2 errors and the power function. You want that to be big, so the probability of a type 2 error will be small. This results in a paradox. If we improve the accuracy of our measurements or the size of our sample in the strong use, we make the theory take a bigger risk because there's a bigger chance of the hypothesis being refuted if the theory is false. Whereas in soft psychology, when we're refuting H null to support our theory, since H null is quasi always false, it means that the power increases, the probability of proving the theory increases even if the theory isn't true because of this whole class of theories, all of which are capable of saying the A's should be bigger than the B's. All right? So the critique of Licken, Neil, Rosenbaum, and others is directed at NHST as a subdivision of TOS. It's not directed at the strong use where we theory predicts H star. When I was a graduate student here during World War II, none of my professors questioned this. It's not that they worried about it and came up in favor of it. Nobody even worried about it. Everybody took it for granted. If you have a psychological theory of schizophrenia or of attachment or of introversion or whatever, Hall's theory of learning, that the way you test it is to refute the null hypothesis. And if you succeed in doing that, then that doesn't clinch your theory, but it strongly supports it. I had courses in four social science departments, this one, ed psych, child psych, and sociology, and I never heard a peep from a single professor raising any question about whether this is a powerful way to do things. There was one professor that didn't do it, and that was Fred Skinner. I had the good fortune to be here as a student when he was here on the faculty. And he didn't do it, but that wasn't because he had some mathematical or philosophical objection to it. He didn't do it because he didn't need to. In the Skinner box, where you have lots of control, the only things that happen in there are things that you do or that the rat does. And there are individual differences among rats, but they don't prevent you from discerning the laws very clearly. I mean, if it's a fixed interval, you'll get a scalloped curve, accumulated record. If it's a fixed ratio, you'll get a staircase. If it's variable ratio, you'll get a smooth thing, and the slope depends on the drive and the reinforcement probability. That kind of stuff is not washed out by the phenomena of individual differences, which Skinner wasn't interested in. He didn't deny they were there, but he didn't have to do a significance test. Now, having been raised on this, I, of course, practiced it. Experiments I did on latent learning in the 40s and 50s, I did significance tests. As it happens, that particular controversy is one in which refuting H null is strong rather than weak. But I won't go into why that is. If you know anything about that controversy, you know what I'm saying. And in my early multiphasic research, I didn't hesitate to use a significance test. How I come to criticize them, I was one of the earliest critics, not the earliest. David Backhand wrote a paper a year before my 1967 article, and Bill Rosenbaum a couple of years before that. In the 1950s, the mathematical biologist Lancelot Hogben wrote a critique of MHST. And you can even go back to World War II. In 1942, Joseph Bergson wrote a critique of MHST. He was chief statistician at the Mayo Clinic. Hardly anybody in psychology or sociology paid any attention to these critical papers. It's just as if they had not been written. And by 1970, there were enough critical papers that Morrison and Henkel, is that in the references?
Yes.
Morrison and Henkel, sociologists, were able to collect them into a book called The Significance Test Controversy, which was also widely ignored. I haven't read the reviews of it, but I do know that it had made no dent in what the psychologists did about significance testing. Now, the way I got into it, it's an interesting illustration of a point often in science where the scientist has a kind of spin-off or side effect from something he's doing. And the spin-off or side effect is actually of more scientific value than what he was doing to begin with. And that's what happened to me. In 1962, in my presidential address to the APA, I propounded a speculative theory of schizophrenia, which was not well received. The applause was quite perfunctory. And as I figured it would be, because I knew that students in the clinical program didn't like this theory. And it was very heretical for the time. First of all, it said this thing is genetic, which now practically any informed person, unless he's a fanatic, knows. And secondly, the going theory at that time was some environmental interpretation, and the favorite was the battle axe mother theory, who traumatized the kid and that made him schizophrenic. There never was any good quantitative evidence for that theory. It was based upon the experience of psychotherapists. Neurotic patient is not likely to say, I hate my goddamn mother. The only type of patient in my experience that will say stuff like that is a schiz. And so it was understandable people who should think that she did it. But there are many alternative explanations. Secondly, my theory said that what's inherited is not psychiatric but neurological. This is a subtle neurological defect which I called schizotaxia, and about which I had some neurophysiological speculations which I probably shouldn't have, not being a brain scientist. The theory was that the people with this neurological thing, only a small number, like 10%, develop schizophrenia. So schizophrenia here is not the main disease, but it's a complication of the main thing. Like kidney failure can be a complication of diabetes, or multiple sclerosis later in life can be a delayed complication of mumps, things like that. That theory also was widely ignored until the middle 80s, when several people picked it up, and now it's doing quite well. It certainly is improved, but it's in pretty good shape in terms of the evidence. Well, Herb Gottesman needled me, saying, you got this theory and you haven't done any research to test it. Actually, I had published two things. One was a tech report based upon my private practice, giving a checklist of signs and a cutting score. And the other was something that appeared quite a bit later on detecting it with the MMPI. But it's not true that I wasn't trying to research it. During that period, right around my APA speech in 1962-63-64, I was engaged in research on my theory. I had a full-time research associate, Dr. Jack Powers, and we did, I don't know, anywhere from 7 to 9 studies. And they varied a lot from studying nystagmus, post-rotatory nystagmus. If you rotate a person in a Borrani chair or squirt ice water in his ear, he has nystagmus, and in schizophrenics it's reduced. We didn't get very far with that one. We had trouble reading the damn records, for one thing. We built a pleasure deficiency key for the MALT. We tried to make a schizotypal scale that wouldn't be psychotic. We did a study of several hundred VA patients. That one we should have written up. That was kind of interesting. Instead of starting with diagnosis or with symptoms, we start with the multiphasic. We identified multiphasic as schizophrenic from some criteria I had earlier published. And what we found was quite interesting, and that is about 23% of them didn't present with any mental symptoms, but with somatic symptoms. We probably should have published that one. Anyway, the point is, in the middle 60s, I began to wonder why I hadn't published more of this stuff. At that time, only the tech report. And on reflection, I realized that I hadn't written it up because it didn't prove anything. I mean, some of these studies didn't reach statistical significance, and some of them did at the 05 level. But you look at them and you say, it is, considering these studies collectively, do they strongly support Meehl's theory? No. Do they strongly refute it? No. You really don't know what to say. Well, I didn't know what to say about that philosophically, but that's why I didn't write the stuff up. I knew that it didn't prove much of anything pro or con. Now I have to tell you something that would embarrass me a bit if I didn't know the history of science. That is the extent to which reasonably bright people can be blind, dumb, including Einstein. About the same time, the philosopher Paul Feyerabend, who was a friend of mine, gave me a gift copy of Sir Karl Popper's book, The Logic of Scientific Discovery, which I strongly recommend to you. And I read that, and I was impressed by it, but I had my philosopher's hat on. And I didn't, believe it or not, it took me 3 or 4 years and arguments with David Licken, whose office was near me in the medical school, to see the deep connection here. So I want to tell you something about Sir Karl Popper. I am not, contrary to rumor, a Popper disciple. Popper had a lot of opinions and a lot of things, ranging from art and music to ethics and history and quantum mechanics. And I got so tired of people saying, well, you know, Meehl, he's a Popper disciple, that's why he has this crazy view against significance tests, that I made a list of Popper's opinions, 33 in number, and I agreed with only 11. So you can't be a guy's disciple if you think he's 67% mistaken. For example, Popper detested Wagner, whereas I'm like Mark Twain, I think Wagner is not as bad as it sounds. Anyway, I finally made the connection. Popper, well, let me tell you a little bit about the guy. I'm very pleased to see how often Sir Karl Popper's books are now being cited in the psych literature, and I take credit for being the one that peddled him to the profession, without being a disciple. I think he's importantly right about a couple of very big things. A lot of other things I think he's wrong. Sir Karl Popper, knighted by the Queen, not for his philosophy of science book, but for his book on history, was born in Vienna in the early 1900s of a well-heeled family, Jewish by extraction, but Christian by religion, nominal. If that shocks you a bit, it was not unusual at all in those days for unbelieving Jews to get baptized as officially Christian, and nobody cared one way or the other. They did that because of the virulent anti-Semitism of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was even worse than Germany at that time, before pre-Hitler. I never heard him talk about religion. It's the only subject he ever wrote about, to my knowledge. Well, he went to the University of Vienna and was not impressed with most of the professors, so he dropped out. Later, in the late 20s, he finally got a PhD there. And he was a man with very strong social consciousness, concern for the poor and the disadvantaged and the like. For a while, a Marxist, but a socialist, but not later a Marxist. And he also worked as a part-time free for Alfred Adler's child clinic. Well, in 1919, Vienna, following the collapse of the empire and losing the war, was in a state of political turmoil, and the communists and socialists were shooting at each other in the streets. My teacher Feigl said you had to keep your head down in your apartment because a bullet might come through the window. And that bothered Popper. He thought, here are these people who are idealists, who want to benefit mankind and help, and so they're out there murdering one another for their damned ideology. That he worked for Adler indicates that at least he saw some truth to Adler. In 1919, there was a newspaper headline saying, Newton refuted. Newton refuted. And he found himself asking, can I imagine a headline saying Marx refuted? Or Adler refuted? No. Why is that? These theories claim to be sciences. Why are they different from physics? Newton refuted, you know, is because of the eclipse of 1919 where the light bent going around the sun, supported Einstein's theory. And he realized that the thing was that these other theories like Marxism and Adler and Freud, while they could point to certain confirming facts that seemed to fit them, didn't predict any facts that could clearly falsify them. Now, I think he wasn't quite fair to Marx there. I think Marx and Engels did predict, I know they predicted a half a dozen facts, but by 1919, all of those facts were false. So what he should have said is not that Marxism is not a science, but the way the Marxists handle Marxism is not like scientists. They always explain away the facts that could refute them. And he realized in Adler's clinic, no matter what a kid did, Adler could explain it. I mean, if a bunch of boys went out for a shoplifting spree, the kid refused to go because that was stupid, you'd get in trouble. Why did he do that, says Adler? Well, because to show his superiority and counteract his inferiority feelings. Or he went with them and he stole the biggest gold watch. Why did he do that? To show his superiority, to overcome his inferiority complex. They get caught by the cops and he spills the beans. He wants to be in with the cops, they're big shots. That's how he'll feel superior, and so on. And he realized, I never saw Adler scratch his head and say, how can I explain that? Adler's theory was fixed so that no matter what the kid did, he could explain it in those terms. That led Popper to say that the essence of a scientific theory is not that it has some connection with facts, that it has some confirming evidence. The essence of a scientific theory, true or false, is that it predicts certain things which, if they don't pan out right, will kill it. And secondly, he said, strong theories survive dangerous tests. Dangerous, risky tests. Well, as I say, I finally realized that the reason NHST is not an impressive way to evaluate psychological theories is that that's a weak test. It's not a severe test. Okay. Let me take a specific example. Suppose you wanted to test my theory of schizophrenia, if it's neurological, by seeing whether the siblings of schizophrenics who are themselves not sick have a fine regular tremor, and you don't rely on the neurologist looking at a visible tremor. You use the Dunlap steel thing with the holes in it, so the very, very subtle tremor will be detected and have a numerical value. You get some schizophrenic siblings, and you put them through this thing, and sure enough, they have significantly finer, more tremor. Bleuler, who invented schizophrenia, said they also have it upon clinical remission, which is interesting. Those who have it, they don't all have it. Well, okay, you do a significance test, and sure enough, the siblings of schizophrenics have more tremor than the controls. Do we jump up and down with joy and say, well, good, good for Beale, that clinches it, his theory's in? No, we don't say that. Why don't we say that? Well, you all know the answer to that, whether you've had philosophy of science or not. The answer, of course, is that there's numerous other theories which can also do a good job to explain tremor that don't involve Beale's theory. When I was writing an article on this, I asked myself how many theories could I think up in a hurry, and in 5 minutes I thought up five others. For example, the battle axe mother theory. If she traumatized the proband, she probably traumatized the siblings too, and so they're a little bit anxious, and as a result they have tremor. Nothing about Beale. Or Mednick had a theory based upon Hull's learning thing about gradients of the anxiety thing. I don't remember the details, and that would do it. Or the siblings were a little worried that since they had this crazy brother, maybe they are going to get schizophrenia too, and they know that's why they're in your experiment, and so they get anxious, and so they have a tremor. You know how it goes. It's easy. Suppose I can think up six theories explaining why the siblings have a tremor. Some philosophers like to think of that in terms of Bayes' rule, Bayes' theorem, which is up on the board. If you want to know the posterior probability that this theory is true, and once you do the experiment, and sure enough, you get the tremor. Well, upstairs we have the prior probability on each of the theories, or Beale's theory upstairs, times the conditional that if Beale's theory were true, they'd have tremor. You repeat that downstairs, and then the second term is the sum of all of the corresponding products for the competing theories. Well, suppose we assume that the prior probability of each is 1/6, like in a die, if there's no reason to prefer one or the other. And suppose they all have about the same conditional probability of the evidence, meaning the tremor, given the theory. If you plug those values into Bayes' formula, you will find that the posterior probability of Beale's theory, now that you've done this experiment, is only 1/6. The odds are 5-1 against, which is not very impressive. I'm not an orthodox Bayesian, but you should know that that's one way that some philosophers think about this stuff. One day in our seminar, Will Grove and I, during a break, wrote down all of the theories of schizophrenia that we could think of. we got 45. If you plug that into Bayes, suppose that half of them can predict tremor, which would be very easy. The neurological ones would, and so would all of these social anxiety ones. And so now your posterior probability is only about 0.05. Well, that's one way of looking at this problem. Another way is Lincoln's crud factor. I don't know whether in his article he used that term. Maybe the editor didn't let him use it. I should have checked it. But anyway, the idea is there. And Lincoln's crud factor is very simple. It says, in soft psychology, everything is correlated with everything. In soft psychology, H null is always, or quasi always, false. And since in soft psychology, everything is correlated with everything, the fact that you can refute H null, if you have high power, doesn't support any theory very much. A little bit, but not very much. That is, theory aside, everything is correlated with everything. Some people have denied that, but the research data are clear. There are a half a dozen studies in the literature, and one of them is summarized in one of the two reprints you have, showing that if you have a big enough sample, H null is always or quasi always false. Theory aside. Lincoln and I got, 60,000 or something protocols from the Counseling Bureau of high school seniors, answering a variety of questions that a counselor might be interested in, like how many siblings do you have, do you have a room of your own to study in, how far did your mother go in school, what's your religion, and various hobbies and interests and kinds of people they like. And our major categorization, the course things, we set up 105 chi-square tables, every one of which was significant at the 0.1 level. Cutting it finer, another 900 or so, 95% were significant at the 0.1 level. And the probabilities are peachy keen, like 10 to the minus 6. So if you're a conventional psychologist, you say, look at that, the probability is only 1 in 10,000 that you would get this trend. Now, some of these correlations you can explain after the fact, and some of them are totally spooky. I mean, why do more Methodists than Lutheran kids say they like social dancing? Beats the hell out of me. You can divide the Lutheran boys by synods. In the Missouri Synod versus the ELC, I used to be a Lutheran in my youth, and the Missouri Synod boys prefer electricity as a shop, whereas the ELC prefer woodwork. And I can spin a theory about that. The Missourians came from Bavaria or Saxony after the Revolution of 1848, and they were also pissed at the state church, which united them with Calvinists. So they came for ideological reasons. My Norwegian ancestors came over here in the 1870s or 80s, not for ideological reasons, and they didn't mind the Norwegian Lutheran Church, but because they were so damn poor in Norway. And so when they got over here, they became either farmers or lumberjacks, and whether they were Norwegians, Danes, or Swedes, the WASPs who ran things in Minnesota, believe it or not, in those days, the WASPs were always governor, they called us dumb Swedes. The whole group. So there might be a little IQ difference here, huh, in the gene pool. As a result of that, since electricity takes a little more brains than woodwork, you can see why the Missouri. The point I'm making is that you can't predict these goofy things from any good theory before the fact, and after the fact you can predict some of them, and you can explain some of them, but not others. Take the MMPI. I suppose most of you being in your field don't know anything about it, but it's a miscellaneous set of items about everything under the sun. Most of the items are not about mental illness, although that's why it was built. It's about personal attitudes, about hobbies, about your feelings about different people, about political ideas. So you've got these crazy ones like everything tastes the same, or most of the time I wish I were dead. But you also have some in the normal region, or at the top of my head feels tender. And then you have others like I wish I were not so shy. I like to go to parties where there's lots of loud fun. I like tall women. Policemen are honest. Nothing like that. Okay, well, Wendell Swenson, who was chief psychologist at the Mayo Clinic, had something like 25,000 of these, I believe, mostly non-psychiatric patients. And he was interested in how many of these items discriminate sex. Now, there are only about 50 items in the femininity key. But if you just ask, how many of these items show a significant difference between males and females? And the answer is something like, I believe, 94% of them do. Well, you read those items and you can't figure out what the heck is going on. What's the first one on the list there?
Sometimes when I'm not feeling well, I'm cross.
Sometimes when I'm not feeling well, I'm cross. Another one in there is, I don't even know which sex tends to answer that one. I have no idea. I think Lincoln was greater than Washington. Well, that's feminine. Well, you can explain that. I know, I can explain that. Women tend to be more nurturant and caring on the average than men. And men tend to be more dominant and aggressive on the average. You know, what child psych people showed years ago that in nursery school or playground, the little boys are 3.5 times as likely to hit another kid over the head with an iron truck. Whereas little girls, if they use violence, are more likely to slap somebody and much more likely not to hit them at all, but to say something spiteful. So you have these sex differences. All right. I think Lincoln is greater than Washington, sure. I sometimes tease animals, that's masculine. Well, you can say that's like the women's, like the women's lib, the feminists say, yeah, that's because men are mean, ugly bastards. They're mean, they're cruel, they're aggressive. And so they tease animals a mile far of it. Well, I don't want to run this into the ground. The point is there are several other studies that involve large hens, and what they uniformly show is that H null, take it literally, is never or almost never true. If we look at multiphasic scales instead, psychasthenia, schizophrenia, depression, mania, and so on, you're dealing here with diagnostic entities. They're opposite in some cases. Certainly mania seems opposite to depression. An obsessional neurotic is opposite to a psychopath, for Pete's sake. And in Freudian theory, an obsessional and a hysteric are somewhat opposite. What happens? In both normal and abnormal samples, we find that the average correlation, median correlations, are about 0.45. Even mania and depression in some samples is positively correlated. Psychologists not only did a similar study with 60,000, everything is significant. Okay, 2 points about Lincoln's crud factor. It's not the case, it is the case that H null is always or almost always false, and it's not the case that they're piddling. Some of them are, of course, with a big N, they're small. But many of them are not. You get correlations in the region of 40 to 60 or 40 to 50. Those are the kinds of correlations that in soft psychology are frequently cited as evidence for a theory, right? Remember, a few correlation coefficients in social psych or clinical psych are bigger than 50. People commonly would cite a correlation of 35 if it's shown to be statistically significant as evidence for the theory. Whereas according to Lincoln, and I agree with him, it is evidence for the theory, but it's rather weak evidence for the theory. Now, a fourth way of looking at this is in terms of the logician. And on your sheet, you have some symbolic logic. P and Q are propositions. The horseshoe is if-then or implies. and the tilde is not. The implicative syllogism has four figures. The first figure says, if P then Q, assert P, conclude Q. That's a valid argument, isn't it? If this is sugar, it will dissolve. It is sugar, so it'll dissolve. It's called bonus ponens, from the Latins to set up. The second figure, if P then Q, not P, therefore not Q. That's fallacious. If this is sugar, it will dissolve. It's not sugar, therefore it won't dissolve. No, it could be salt or any other soluble thing. That's called denying the antecedent, the fallacy. The third figure, affirming the consequence, says if P then Q, Q infer P. If this is sugar, it's soluble. I dump it in, it dissolves, and I say therefore it's sugar. It could be salt again. And the fourth figure is called modus tollens, the destructive mood, which is a valid argument. If P then Q, not Q, therefore not P. It's interesting, a study showed that 20% of chemists think that's an invalid argument, believe it or not, and 30% of biologists think it's an invalid argument. Well, here's the bad news. The confirming of a scientific theory by its ability to predict something in the lab or the clinic is in the third figure, isn't it? We say if Mills' theory were true, then they'd have tremor. They do have tremor, so good for Mills' theory. Ordinary scientific inference supporting a theory from its ability to derive a fact is a logically an invalid form. And the philosophers have a little witticism about this that you should memorize. Morris Raphael Cohen, philosopher at Columbia, I think it was for many years, he said, in all logic texts are divided into two parts. In the first part, on deductive logic, the fallacies are explained. In the second part, on inductive logic, they are committed. And that's what we do, isn't it? Now, why do we do that? Because we can't do any better, despite David Hume. The other P's that could explain the Q's in the third figure, we try to whittle them down by showing that they won't successfully predict certain Q's that our P predicts, or that they do predict some other Q's that are false in the lab or the clinic. Now, what we have in the back of our mind here is not only the actual competitors that are before us, which we're looking at, but some vague class of possible alternative theories, which the logicians claim are infinite number. I don't believe that, by the way, and I've never seen a theorem to that effect. And they say, if you put that in Bayes' formula, no matter what your evidence is, it's very, very improbable that any theory is right. I don't accept that either. So what we like, the reason we like risky Popperian risk is that vague collection of theories that nobody has even conceived of yet, and maybe nobody ever will, but which might explain some facts, it would be very odd if a totally different theory from ours made a whole bunch of successful numerical point predictions, wouldn't it? Would be, as Wesley Salmon says, a damn strange coincidence. I've never seen a formal proof of this. I have tried to develop one in a forthcoming paper. Oh, no, it has appeared in a recent paper on climatics, but I'm not very satisfied with that proof. And this is one of those intuitive things that all working scientists accept, and most philosophers of sciences grudgingly accept, but that nobody has formally proved, and they should just keep working until they can. We like risky predictions because in the back of our mind we have this conception of a large class of competing theories, including those that nobody has thought of yet and some that nobody ever will, and we think if one of these other theories is totally dissimilar to ours, that makes these several numerical predictions, that would be very strange. That it could, might be right about one of them or two of them, but it could make five of them, that would be highly unlikely. Now, when you consider the asymmetry between the fourth and the third figure here, you realize that a box score of 7-3, 7 coming out the way you said and 3 not, is not very impressive, because the 3, if accepted, are falsifiers, and the 7 are weak confirmers. And most psychologists who haven't taken freshman logic don't have a full appreciation of that either. Most psychologists, at least in my field, if you published a review and you came out with 7-3 for Beal's theory, they would say, well, that's pretty good. I mean, you can't always get it right. 7-3, that's certainly in the favor. A logician would say, oh no, if you accept those 3, the theory is killed, despite the 7, all right? NHST is not risky. And if you start with accepting Licken's crud factor, it's quite unrisky. It really depends not upon the truth of your theory, but upon the power function. Now, as regards the power function, I know I'm supposed to stop at 5, but we got started late, so I'm going to spill over for a few minutes. That's okay. About the power function, one of the problems of NHST is that, as used, they almost never give you the power. I don't know what percent of articles I've read over the years in which the power is stated, but I know it's less than 10%. And this is partly Fisher's fault. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with Fisher's mathematics, but he didn't like to talk about power because he didn't invent it. Fisher was a very arrogant, dogmatic, brilliant man, and he didn't like Nyman and Pearson's 1933 paper about the two kinds of errors, and all the subsequent editions of his design of experiments hardly recognizes their existence. And a psychologist characteristically neglect to mention the power, and that means they count as something as evidence against the theory, which would count against modus tollens, because you don't squeak through refuting H null, and your power is not very big. Now, here again we have hard data. Jacob Cohen, eminent psychometrician, author of a definitive treatise on this, co-author with his wife, with a classic thing on multiple regression. He published in the early 60s. It's amazing how long it takes for psychologists to pay attention to something. It's really amazing. In the 1960s, he took a complete sample of articles in the Journal of Abnormal and looked at their power to detect a difference of, I think it was a fourth of a sigma. He said a difference that big is big enough you'd want to find it if it was there. He also did it for one half a sigma and one sigma. And he found that less, and he said, if you're going to do a significance test, or if you're going to refute a theory by failing to get significance, you ought to have at least 80% power. Now that's pretty liberal, isn't it? That means you're willing to use this test and wrongly claim that this evidence is against somebody's theory 1 out of 5 times. So he was quite liberal. He wasn't being perfectionist. And he found that with a fourth of a sigma separation between the true means, that less than 50% of the articles had 80% power. Well, nobody ever wrote a reply. Nobody ever refuted either his facts or his reasoning. 25 years later, two Germans, Gigerenzer and Stadelmeier, sampled the same journal using the same criteria he used. And guess what? The percentage having adequate power had slightly decreased. Now, you know, I don't like to foul my own nest. I'm a clinician. That tells me that abnormal psychology is in a primitive pre-scientific state. Isn't it? You can't really imagine, can you, that if an eminent, high-repute chemist showed that the litmus test was accurate in detecting acids and bases less than half the time, that 25 years later, chemists would continue to use it without apology. I mean, that's crazy. There's something wrong with the field, something wrong with the editors. Now, since we can't expect to have a perfect batting average due to certain obfuscators, and that's on your pass out, and I'm not going to have time to talk about it at length, but you have a formula there for confirming theories, which says that, which shows that when you try to predict a certain observational relation that O1 implies O2 from your theory, you can almost never do it from T, the theory alone. Almost never, even in physics. When you look close at any experiment, you find that in addition to the theory itself, in order to get to the predicted observational fact, you need to have four other kinds of things called auxiliaries. One of them is the second term there. I don't know if it's T-aux or aux-T, but it's an auxiliary theory that you have to rely on. You're not studying it, you're studying T. But you have to rely on the auxiliary theory. For instance, if I'm studying something about emotion and using the GSR, I have to have the auxiliary theory that anxiety reduces skin resistance. That's not what I'm investigating. I'm investigating Neil's theory of schizophrenia, maybe. But I have to rely on this other theory. Then they have CP, ceteris paribus, a phrase which I urge you to memorize. The Latin students will recognize it as an ablative absolute, ceteris paribus. And it means other things being equal. It doesn't mean they're equal for every individual. Then there wouldn't be any IDs. You wouldn't need a significance test. It means that the thing that you're manipulating or the variable on which you're selecting is not unknown to you, a correlate of some other nuisance thing that's going to get into the act and push the things around. Then we have, I guess it's capital I, aux, instrumental auxiliary. That means that you have to believe in the validity of whatever tests you're using. And in my field, that's a very, very touchy one. For example, suppose I'm studying some interaction of social introversion with some experimental manipulation I'm going to do. And I'm going to use the social introversion scale of the MMPI. Well, a scale has a reliability coefficient of around 80, but the validity studies would make validity more like 50. So around 65%, 64% of the variance is reliable, but only 25% is valid. And so that means the other 40% is what? Reliable, invalid variance. And what is that going to do to the ceteris paribus clause? If I had time, I would spell out a research thing to show you how dangerous these can be. But suppose you say that over a class of experiments you do in your field, 90% of the time the auxiliary, each auxiliary type is met. Well, 9 squared is brings me down to about 64, 65. That means that over a class of experiments in a given domain, I will get apparent falsifiers of my theory about one time in three. So that's very non-Popperian, see? Popper would say those three are killers. What we have to say is, no, they speak against, but they aren't killers, because there's one chance in three that the auxiliaries aren't already satisfied. Well, this is a conceptual mess, and I would like to be able to propound a beautiful, elegant solution, but I do not have one. I am working on it in my work on cliometrics. One thing that people currently are saying is that's why we should use meta-analysis. The old narrative type research report is just too darn hard to interpret. But if we use meta-analysis, we'll get it. I'm strongly in favor of meta-analysis. I don't agree with the critics like Isaac and Klein. But I am not convinced that it will do this job. Meta-analysis was not invented to appraise theories. That may surprise you. Gene Glass of Colorado, who invented it only to appraise, to evaluate interventions. And I wrote to him 30 years ago, and he said, that's right. And all of his examples in his book are evaluating interventions. I emailed him recently, and he's still of the same opinion. He doesn't condemn its use for theories. He just says that's not what it was intended to do. Now, there are several reasons why I'm doubtful about it. The first is that meta-analysis looks for big effect sizes and says the more the better. And that's not what we want in appraising theories, is it? We want the closer the better, and that's different. I mean, if you study Meehl's theory of schizophrenia, you say 90% of the probands are correctly diagnosed. And then according to Meehl's theory, 80 to 90% of those have the schizotaxic brain, and the others are genophenocopies. And those who are schizotaxic, if it's a dominant gene, half of the siblings will have this. Okay, you get 0.9 times 0.8 to 0.9 times 0.5, you get down to 35 to 40. As the expected schizotaxic base rate among the SIBs. Notice how different that is from the way people usually think. A typical significance tester is going to say, well, that's not very good. I mean, that's only about 1 in 3. And he'd like it to be, say, 55 instead of 35. But that's wrong, isn't it? If you got 55% schizotaxic brains in the siblings, Meehl's theory would be refuted. So not the bigger the better, but the closer the better. Now, maybe meta-analysis can be fixed up so that we stick that into the formula, but nobody's worked out the math of that, and I'm too old and blind to try. But that's one problem. But the second thing is it doesn't involve risk at all. And risk is crucial because that's what gives a strong test. There's no measure of risk in the meta-analytic procedure, as you know. Thirdly, if you read the history of science, you realize that there are at least 11 properties of theories that scientists use in appraising them. At least 11. I have a list in my recent paper. And maybe another 7, which makes 18. Like there are 4 kinds of parsimony, for example. And so I conclude until further notice that I think the meta-analysis is peachy keen for evaluating drugs or psychotherapy or the effect of television on aggression or any of those intervention things. Well, finally, to wind up, I do have to say one more thing. Critics of Licken, Meehl, Rosenbaum and company have said, well, maybe you guys have a good argument. I can't exactly answer all your arguments, but R.A. Fisher was a great statistician, and he used null hypothesis testing in agronomy, and so I'm going to stick by it. How do you explain that? Why does it work there? And the answer is very simple and easy. In agronomy, the substantive causal theory and the statistical hypothesis are practically identical. See, when we say the fertilized plots have more corn yield than those that weren't fertilized, that's the statistical hypothesis we prove by refuting H null. And then we say fertilizer helps grow corn. That's the substantive causal hypothesis. What's the difference between those? None that anybody would care about unless he was a philosopher, right? Only in a seminar on Hume, where you're arguing about causality or induction, would you even see any difference. If you're an economist or the Hindu minister of agriculture or a farmer, these two are essentially identical in their content. So when you prove one, you have proved the other. That's not true in soft psychology and mostly not in hard psychology, is it? The statistical hypothesis being proved, siblings of schizophrenics have more tremor. That's not equivalent to Meehl's theory of schizotaxia by a long shot. See, Meehl's theory implies that hypothesis. But the hypothesis does not imply Meehl's theory because of the third figure of the syllogism. So that's my answer to saying it works fine in agronomy. It works fine in testing drugs, too. It works fine in studying whether small classes are better for learning fractions. All of those studies that were intervention, there's essentially no difference between the statistical hypothesis you're proving and the substantive causal theory that you're interested in proving or refuting. What we would like to have is some way of combining characteristics of theories in relation to the data that would give us a number of some kind comparable to what we get in Bayes' formula. Nobody has developed such a thing. The cliometric meta-theory approach of Faust and Meehl is one way of looking at it, but it's entirely speculative at this as of this time. I do have some formal proofs that show under general conditions which theory attributes you should expect to be correlated with truth. But my view is that in order to assign the weights to these 11 or 18 factors, start with the 11, is necessary to do empirical research from the scientific literature, but that's a long story on a different point. I know that this is not the kind of lecture that students like to hear, because if you are addicted to null hypothesis significance testing, I'm taking away your security blanket. It is clear to me, without doing any statistics, that things are improving. One now frequently sees error bars instead of significance tests in the literature, especially in the APS literature. You can get an article published now without doing a significance test. And people are, editors are routinely saying you've got to have some measure of overlap. Effect size is one thing. And another measure of overlap, what I was taught by Donald Patterson you should use, is to state the percentage of the one group that reaches or exceeds the 10th, 25th, 50th, 75th, and 90th percentile of the other group. He didn't insist on that in editing the Journal of Applied, but he often urged people to do it. And his reasoning there is that the region in which you're interested will vary from one reader to another. And so what percent of what group exceeds a group of normals would vary depending on whether I'm in the counseling bureau or in a state hospital. So the point I'm making is that NHST, while not meaningless, is a very weak, feeble way of appraising the truth of theories, and psychologists should quit doing it as much as they can. The real solution would be to make strong enough theories that we can make numerical point predictions, as they do in some other areas. Whether we will ever be able to do that in fields like psychopathology or social psychology, I don't know. I hope we will be able to do it someday, but as yet, we're not able to do it. Intermediate degrees should be done. For example, when we, McCorkadale and I, axiomatized Tolman's cognitive learning theory in the 1950s, we didn't try to make numerical predictions, but we did say things like the strength of an expectancy is a monotone increasing decelerated function of the number of exposures. And that's not as strong as saying it's a log or a parabola, but it's stronger than saying the A's are bigger than the B's, because it's telling you that the sign of the first derivative is positive throughout and the sign of the second derivative is negative throughout. I believe that we underestimate the extent to which one can derive interesting mathematical consequences from intermediate strength theories. I'm not an expert on chaos theory or catastrophe theory, but people on this campus who are experts tell me, yeah, you can get quite a few interesting equations, although you can't get the parameters usually, out of fairly semi-qualitative theories. And we should start trying to do that so that we will be using the strong use as much as possible rather than the weak use. And I guess that should be about it. Anybody have any comments or questions? Don't be timid. guess I'm either cowed or traumatized. All right, let's call it a day.